Growing up in the 50s, it was a great age of cars. And a lot of young guys were interested in cars. I mean, they could take apart an engine by themselves and put it back together again. And me, I don't know a spark plug from a hubcap. While they were thinking about cars and football, I was thinking about Ascots and Mambo.
Okay, we're gonna get to the Mambo stuff later, and trust me, it's kind of amazing. But the other half of Bruce Boyer's youthful obsession, Ascots, should come as a surprise to no one who's heard the first three chapters of this podcast series. From a young age, Bruce thought deeply about clothes. And while we've heard about his discovery of Ivy League, English tailoring, and Italian style, there's a key ingredient missing. And it's not the clothes he wore, it's how he wore them, his personal style. And a lot of that was inspired by one place, Hollywood. This is Unbuttoned, G. Bruce Boyer's Life in Clothes, Chapter 4. Unbuttoned is brought to you by Shibumi Firenze. Whether it's ties, pocket squares, shirts, or socks, the thing that connects everything at Shibumi is a dedication to classic style.
I think it's very difficult when you're doing very classical kind of clothing to find something different that's, in a way, you know, the perfect example of the genre, to get the mix of colors right and the proportions of things right. People think that that's easy to do because it's been around forever, but it's the hardest thing to do.
Discover Shibumi Firenze for yourself at shibumi-firenze.com. Use the offer code UNBUTTONED for 10% off. If you know Bruce's work, then this episode's theme will come as no surprise. Not only has he written numerous articles about Hollywood's influence on style, he's written books about its golden age icons. I'm Pedro Mendez, and what I wanted to know is how Hollywood influenced Bruce's own style, his approach to dressing and building a wardrobe, and, of course, how that influence began. But before we get to that, we need to have a flashback to Bruce's younger days before classic style entered the frame.
The first style that I remember taking up with a vengeance was the rebel style. The black thick-soled engineer boots and the black leather motorcycle jackets and white tight t-shirts with your cigarettes rolled up in the sleeve.
Wait, guys actually did that?
Oh yeah. That wasn't a fiction of Hollywood. That was, Hollywood took it from the guys on the street. I think the reason was because their jeans were too tight. I mean, you couldn't carry your cigarettes in the pocket of your trousers. You would crush the cigarettes.
Now, before you get the wrong idea, because you're probably picturing Marlon Brando in The Wild One, or if you're my age, Fonzie from Happy Days, Bruce wasn't a street tough. And his rebel phase didn't last that long. By the time he was finishing high school, as we heard in Chapter 1, he had discovered Ivy League. Also, right around then, he began to really pay attention to films from before the war, especially the style on display.
I started to say to myself, we all agree that any of these guys, they look great, but you can either go two ways with it. You can say, well, they just look good in whatever they put on. That's an end to it. There's nothing to be learned there. Those guys just are special and it's a mystery and so forth. Or you can say, how do we account for this? You know, why do they look better than other guys? I think that's the approach I took. I started to look at these guys, you know, and say, maybe they look good because they know what they're doing. Maybe they're better tailored and so forth because they've studied themselves a little bit and they know what they can wear and what they can't wear. And I came to the realization that, in fact, was the truth. Anybody can dress badly. Some people choose not to.
As you can guess, Bruce chose not to. But he still had to learn, still had to develop his own style. And part of that development was influenced by something he was passionate about at the time. Something that came, I've got to be honest, as a total surprise to me.
I loved to dance when I was young, and I was a very good dancer. I introduced Mambo to the South Side. I was great. I was the best dancer in town. I always loved music. Music has been a great joy and a refuge and a consolation, an uplifting spirit in my life. And dance goes along with that. So naturally, I was drawn to Fred Astaire. Astaire, above anybody else in a way, was not what we would expect from our romantic heroes. He was shorter than a lot of guys in the movies. He was short to the point of being skinny, maybe almost emaciated. He certainly was not characteristically handsome. In fact, when he went to Hollywood, a number of people thought he looked like Stan Laurel of Laurel and Hardy. You know, at one critic said that his head resembled the Bartlett pear. And yet, with all of that, he looked fabulous. And you came to realize, or at least I did, that Astaire's weapon was style. He was almost the pure personification of style. You know, he had buckets of it. You got to think, watching him, that, you know, maybe I could approach that somehow. Maybe I could emulate him a little bit. Maybe I could learn something from him. And then maybe I could get a girl like Ginger Rogers too, you know.
Bruce never met his style icon before Astaire passed away in 1987. Then, in 2005, he published Fred Astaire Style, in which he made the case for Astaire being the greatest influence on American style in the 20th century. That caught the attention of Oxford University, which led Bruce to meet, if not Astaire himself, then at least his close family.
I got a call from somebody at Oxford, and she was mad about Fred Astaire, and she wanted to put on a conference. The idea was that Fred Astaire was the greatest entertainer of the 20th century, and she would invite scholars there. And I talked about Fred Astaire as the new American hero. Fred Astaire's daughter, Ava, came to the conference with her husband. His name was Richard. I got to talk with them for a good long time. Ava's husband was telling me Fred got a new Rolls Royce one year. He said he was going to take us all out to dinner. So he came by the house and he said, wait till you see this car. It's, you know, it's great and everything. And so we went out and looked at it. And boy, I thought it was terrific. And I told him, I said, you know, Fred, this is just fabulous. And Fred just threw me the keys and said, you drive it. And Richard said, oh, Fred, I couldn't do that. I'd be afraid I'd scratch it or, you know, something. And Fred said, no, it's only a car. It just struck me that it wasn't an overbearing kind of thing to do. It was that it was just the casualness about him, you know, that he just didn't take a lot of things that seriously.
Now, returning to Bruce's youth, Fred Astaire wasn't the only icon of the silver screen to have influenced his approach to style. You may expect, as I did, that the other one was Cary Grant. Not quite.
Gary Cooper interested me because I had, and I don't even remember how I was able to do this, but I got to see his early movies. And in his early movies, he did some cowboy movies, but he did a lot of movies where he played a more kind of lightweight sophisticate.
I've listed some of these movies, all from the 1930s, in this episode's show notes. As Bruce tells me, they aren't all necessarily great films, but worth watching for Cooper's style. They include Bluebeard's Eighth Wife, a romantic comedy that begins with Cooper's character wanting to buy pajamas without the trousers. The plot thickens from there. And Desire, a movie that's supposed to be centered around a jewel heist, but is really just one long excuse for many, many love scenes between Cooper and co-star Marlene Dietrich.
And if you look at those films, his dress is so sophisticated. Well, I think a lot of the clothing was made in Savile Row and in Rome and so forth. But the interesting thing about Cooper, and it was almost unlike any of the other film stars of the time, he could wear a bespoke suit, or he could wear jeans and a flannel shirt and cowboy boots with the same sense of sophisticated, elegant ease. And nobody else could do that. As far as I know, Astaire tried that in one or two movies. He wore jeans and cowboy boots, and it was almost painful to watch this. It just didn't work. So I that kind of fascinated me. You know, how could a guy be able to do that? I always thought that there was something to Cooper that wasn't obvious in a way, but it was still there.
As with Astaire, Bruce never met Gary Cooper. But like Astaire, Bruce did meet Cooper's daughter, thanks to another book project. In 2011, Bruce published Gary Cooper, Enduring Style, co-written with Maria Cooper Janis.
I started to talk to her about, and I started to read about him, and he was not what he seemed to be on those Western movies. He was a natural sophisticate in a different way. His daughter told me that when he accepted a role for a movie, he would get the wardrobe for that movie as soon as he could, and he would wear it to break it in and to feel comfortable in it, so that when it came to do the movie, he absolutely owned that the clothing. He even would do that with the props. She told me once, I was fascinated by this, that he was making a movie where he was, you know, going to be in a submarine, and the set had a periscope there. And he went on the set and played around all day with that periscope, learning how to look through it and where do you put your arms and everything, so that by the time it came later on to shoot the scene, he looked as though he really were a guy who operated a periscope.
But one main difference between Gary Cooper and Fred Astaire is that, how do I put this? Cooper didn't look like a Bartlett pair.
When he was a young man, he was absolutely gorgeous. And you would think, oh, well, he can wear anything and he's such a handsome guy, it doesn't matter. But that wasn't the truth either. The truth was that he studied himself. He knew what he could wear. He was the guy who first realize that if you're going to be in a cowboy movie and you're going to be portraying a cowboy, you don't want to be seen wearing new jeans. So he would get the jeans and he would wash them himself and slap them around on a rock or something, you know, to break them in. He understood all of that stuff. So he really knew what kind of an image he was projecting, and he very consciously constructed it.
When I began building my own wardrobe, which really only started in my mid-30s, when I went from wearing whatever was in my closet to investing in classic style, I devoured Bruce's books. And the two lessons that kept surfacing were that style is something you cultivate, and that clothing sends a message. In fact, I remember one line in particular: style is neither superficial nor inconsequential. That meant a lot to me because at the time, I was a new dad and I had no idea what being a father meant. In many ways, I still felt like an adolescent. And so, in the hopes of changing what was inside, I changed what was outside. I tried to dress like my image of a grown man to help me feel more grown up. And for me, it helped. As it turns out, Bruce himself learned these important lessons from two of Hollywood's greatest, Astaire and Cooper, two men he never met. But once Bruce began his career in men's style, which we'll hear about in detail in Chapter 6, he did finally meet one of the silver screen's great stars. So the story goes like this. Bruce had convinced his editor-in-chief at Town & Country magazine into doing a menswear supplement, something they'd never done before. Bruce was to write most of the stories, which would also include some photo layouts. But they needed a well-known, well-dressed celebrity for the cover.
When I met him, he was a much older man. In fact, I would think he was about 70. And he had that suntanned skin and the white hair, right? And I mean, it was almost impossible. You know, he just radiated. And I said to him at one point, I said, I didn't look as good as you do when I was 15. You know, I mean, he just looked fabulous. He laughed at that. He had a very good sense of humor, and he was very nice.
He was Douglas Fairbanks Jr., a relatively successful film star, best known for his roles in 1939's Gunga Din, which co-starred Cary Grant, and 1941's The Corsican Brothers, in which he played identical twins. I don't know if he got paid twice for that. Anyway, that film involved a lot of swords and general swashbuckling, which was both a blessing and a curse for Fairbanks Jr.'s career. You see, he was never really able to completely come out of the shadow of his famous father, Douglas Fairbanks, the original swashbuckler, the first to bring Zorro to the silver screen during the silent film era. Later in his career, Fairbanks Jr. went into TV producing, but continued to cultivate his style, appearing in best dress lists into his 70s, which is when Bruce entered the frame.
We shot some photos, and then I took him to lunch. I remember we went to lunch at Mr. Chow's, and I tell you something interesting. We were having lunch, and I finally was able to sit down, you know, at close quarters and really study him. Because when we were shooting photos, you know, everybody's running around and moving around and make sure the lights are right and all that stuff. But I got to study him, and he looked fabulous. As I say, he was probably 70 at that point. And I remember everything he was wearing. He was wearing a beautiful flannel, navy blue, chalk-striped, double-breasted suit with a medium blue end-on-end shirt and a navy tie with the yellow stripes, you know, a rep tie. The two things that really killed me were he was wearing a maroon carnation in his buttonhole, and he was wearing brown alligator tassel loafers. And I said to him, is that a new suit? It looks so great. And he said, well, let's see. And he looked in the, you know, inside pocket. And he said, oh, no, he said, this one, let me see, bump up. He said, this one I had made 28 years ago. I said, wow. I said, that's amazing. I said, it looks just perfect. He said, I've got clothes from the 30s.
It's worth noting a few things about this story. First of all, lunch with Douglas Fairbanks Jr. Damn. Second, Bruce has a photographic memory when it comes to clothes. He also tells me he can picture all 1,000 of his ties in his wardrobe. And I believe it. But most importantly, and this also applies to Astaire and Cooper, there were prominent men in Bruce's orbit who were living examples of elegance and sophistication. That's one of the big reasons I wanted to do this series, because we just don't have that in our culture anymore. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of guys on Instagram who are inspirations when it comes to our dress. But let's be real, it's a subculture. In Bruce's day, these guys were mainstream. And most importantly, it wasn't just that these guys wore good clothes, they knew how to wear them. Geez, they knew how to wear anything and make it look good. At least I can experience that vicariously through Bruce. Now, back in Chapter 1, you heard about American style, Ivy League. And then last time, in Chapter 3, I made the case that Italian style has a lot to thank America for. Well, next time, our ode to the American craftsman, as Bruce shares stories about some of the tailors, shirt makers, and designers he has known over the years. This podcast is a production of the Hogtown Rake. Thank you for listening.